Today's episode of the Film Stage Roundtable is brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. For your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Roundtable, the spin-off podcast from the Film Stage Show at thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me today, we have Michael Snydell.
Hello! Back for round two!
Yeah! And we also have Bill Graham.
Woo!
Oh my god. So, before we begin, I guess I just gotta address the elephant in the room, which is that this is our second time recording this episode.
We love you people that much.
We do. We had some technical issues that led to our first go-through, which we recorded on Tuesday, being corrupted beyond the point of use. Not awesome. So we're back. And we're back on a Thursday, so we are going to be punchy, as always, and we've already done this, so yeah, it's going to be a weird one, ladies and gentlemen, and I hope that you are prepared. So, for anyone who's just turning in for the first time, we talk about film topics, not reviews on these podcasts every other week. We want to extend the invitation. Anyone who has an idea definitely should get in touch with us. In fact, one of our topics today was offered up by a listener, and we're going to talk about it. We love getting suggestions from listeners because you guys think outside of the box that we live in, and also it saves us from having to do any work. So if you'd like [S2] Nice. [S1] To do that, reach out. We can be found on Twitter at Film Stage Show. We can be found on Facebook. Search for The Film Stage Show. And that's about it. Other ways to give feedback, podcast@thefilmstage.com. And of course, it's the Christmas season, and you should gift us with a rating and a comment on iTunes. We are also brought to you, as always, by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. I would love, we've highlighted something else the last time we did this. But I wanted to draw your attention to the fact that Mubi, in the coming days, will be releasing the Jackie Chan Projects. It's a Jackie
Hell
Chan...
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Everyone loves...
I'm
in. In fact, this is great because I was just thinking, like, I want to see some Jackie Chan. And they're doing it. Mubi's giving you two of his features. It's a double feature, so they'll be coming out one after the other. So sign up now, and you will have 30 days to watch these thrilling Jackie Chan films.
But you're going to leave it hanging which Jackie Chan?
They're literally called Project A and Project A2.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So yeah, I just...
I'm hoping for a lot of broken bones and broken noses.
I don't doubt that all of that stuff happened to him. Yeah, so, for instance, Project A is taking parts of inspiration from Harold Lloyd and Buster Keaton, complete with a Safety Last homage.
I'm there.
Yeah, here, I don't even have to say anything.
All right, never mind, you're good.
Yeah. It's funny that, like, you never really, like, when you never really think about Jackie Chan, and then when you do, you're, like, instantly thinking to yourself, God damn it, I need to see one of his movies right
now. Sure.
Yeah.
Yep. So this happened to me yesterday, and so I am super excited that Mubi is coming here to scratch the Jackie Chan itch in our lives.
Mm. Yeah. Netflix doesn't have like anything except a terrible dub of Drunken Master.
Okay.
It's very sad.
Okay, Mubi plug over. So first of all, if you'd like your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage. Because right now I'm about to rip into Netflix. And I don't want people to think it's movie inspired. Netflix has been losing like shows that used to be like Netflix standards. So yesterday I thought to myself, you know what I'd really like to see? I'd really love to see Psych. Like, Psych is just one of those comfort shows that I used to
throw
on.
Is that the one on USA or something like that?
Yeah. The guy is a
I wondered if you watched that.
Yeah. and his friend is Gus, played by Dulé Hill. And they're just like, they're a great pair. The episodes are like typical USA fluff, but like, it's fun and it's interesting. And Netflix doesn't fucking have it anymore, man. They lost it in October, and now I can't find Psych anywhere. And apparently, I didn't know this, but it sent like a ripple through the internet. Like, I found a Reddit that was thousands of people pissed off about this.
Of course you did.
Well, because I Googled it. I was like, I Googled where can I stream Psych, and it's nowhere.
It's so funny. Like, so Netflix has this stupid model where they just randomly will take things off and then kind of maybe sort of react to people. Why don't they give you a choice and be like, hey, we're going to save one of these 10 or 20 things that we're about to let go the rights of. Who wants to save this? And just like, you're an online subscription service. Like, just fucking go to the internet and be like, hey guys, we're about to lose these 20 things. Do any of y'all care? And just see.
I mean, they might literally have control over that, though.
Well,
they have enough control to, like, keep it.
What I read, because this consumed me today, was that Netflix, in their push to do more original content, is freeing up money by getting rid of things that, while popular, are also expensive. So, like, I can still rock Royal Pains, but I don't like Royal Pains. I like Psych. I wanted to watch Psych. I wanted to see Sean and Gus getting into hijinks, and now I can't. So, there's that. and now, how about we actually go into our first topic?
Onto the actual film stage.
We could make a whole roundtable of just, this, like, what's life. The thing that you miss most from Netflix?
Oh, shit. Criterion. Yeah.
Well, we got Filmstruck for that now. And Criterion was on Hulu before it was on, you know, so.
Yeah, I know, but I don't need to have every streaming service in the world, Brian. Obviously, I'm not made of money.
Obviously, you don't need to have Netflix anymore. I think the Gilmore Girls revival proved that. Anyway, let's end.
Don't get me started again, Brian.
Again, my wife cornered me for a good 30 minutes, and I've never seen an episode of the Gilmore Girls, so I was very lost. But I know that she was deeply disappointed. Let's get into our first topic, shall we? Oh, my God. So this topic is named, and I know this is going to infuriate Bill, because, again, we've already done this.
Oh, Jesus.
Food movies.
Oh, hey, good looking. Oh.
The silky smooth tones of Hank Williams singing Hey Good Lookin' as he introduced himself, which I did not know would happen because I did not watch this YouTube video first. I will say that even though we're doing this whole episode over again, I chose two brand new songs to intro these segments because that's just the kind
you
of mess
you spoil us.
So, food movies. Food movies. Film stage show fan Kenneth Grahelli served us up this delicious suggestion, and we couldn't wait to put it on the menu. I already know that joke doesn't land, so moving on. Coming off of the Thanksgiving holiday, we are here to talk about our favorite food movie. So let's just dive right into that. Let's talk about movies that circulate or really focus on food. Michael Snydell. How's about we start off with you?
Sure. I that would be great. Well,
it would be fantastic.
So I was thinking a lot about this, and the grand audience of the Film Stage show actually I mentioned mine a number of times. So I went with something a little bit different. But I have to give some special credit to Stanley Tucci's and Campbell Scott's film Big Night, which if I was going to solely pick a movie based on the food that I see on screen that makes me literally want to, you know, put my hand into the screen and eat it, that's probably the choice I would pick. But I wanted to go to highlight a film that I think was kind of forgotten. It kind of went under the radar. It played at TIFF and Cannes, and it got some scattered applause, which I think I saw it originally on a best of list is which where I first heard about it. And it's a film called The Lunchbox from 2013. And it was a, and it's a, an Indian epistolary film about how two people connect over food. And the basic story is that it's about this surly old widower. And or I should say it's parallel stories of this surly old widower and these newlyweds who the spark has already kind of left their relationship. And these two groups of people are brought together through a system, a very common system in India called Dabowala. I'm very sorry if I mispronounced it. But anyways, it's a national system in India that picks up and delivers lunches from restaurants or homes to people at places of at workplaces. And so basically what happens is that this newlywed, she is trying to rejuvenate their marriage by cooking food that will get his attention. But unfortunately, her meals accidentally keep going to this widower played by Irfan Khan. And again, like, they kind of start a pen pal relationship through food. And they both kind of solve each other's problems. And while this premise has the definite possibility of sounding very sentimental or being very goopy, but it's very smart. It's very well done. And it's just a really low key, but very entertaining and enjoyable film. So I'd absolutely recommend you seek it out. It might be on some streaming service. I'm not sure. And I didn't do my due diligence. So maybe you can find it. It's called The Lunchbox.
All right. Bill Graham, what about yourself?
So when I was looking over the list, I definitely realized that I have a food movie blind spot. There we go. Okay. I said it. Fine. the one and only time today. So I realized that because there's a lot of films on here that I haven't seen, including Lunchbox and a number of others. Some of them I didn't even realize were actually films. Some of them I thought were jokes. And apparently they turn out no, they're real. That's how deep.
Are we talking about Ratatouille?
Partly, but I still haven't looked up and seen what y'all were talking about last time. But
oh my God, Bill,
anyways,
no, pause.
It's glorious. It's glorious.
I can't. I'm in the middle of a podcast, Brian.
All right.
I can't do that. But what I can do is I can tell you my pick, and my pick was Chef. And Chef to me is, this is just really good home cooking for me. I really, really enjoyed this film when it came out. I enjoy the fact that this is Jon Favreau returning back to his roots. He made this quick and dirty. And I say quick and dirty, and yet it stars like every big name actor that he's either worked with or wanted to work with within the last few years. It stars Dustin Hoffman. It's got John Leguizamo. It's got Scarlett Johansson. It's got Robert Downey Jr. in a small little cameo role that's great. Man, this film has a lot of people and really extremely well acted. But more than anything, I think what cinema has to do and it has to rely on is just simply the fact that you don't get to enjoy the smell of food. And if you like do any research into food and kind of like our reaction to it, smell is a incredibly crucial point of that. So much so that, like, when people can't smell, they often can't, like, taste their food very well.
Right. Anyone who's had a head cold will understand that phenomenon.
Yeah. You're talking about because they take rope dust
stuffed up in there.
Oh, okay. Well, I was thinking when you take the Robitussin, you know, you pinch your nose and then you taste it a little bit less, right?
No, I didn't thought of that. That's also a good one.
So we both came up separately with different examples of that. So yeah, it works. Definitely. So what happens is film has a burden to just basically like amp up the visual flair of food. And, you know, if you've ever watched the Hannibal TV series, you know, that is just going to give you a food boner for the rest of your life. That show
American Pie style
really brings the heat as far as like the way that food looks and like the lengths they go to just make that stuff just look so appetizing and so delicious. And I would say that they do a decent job of that here in Chef, but more than anything, what Chef is about is it's just about this cook that's just kind of getting back to his roots, much like Jon Favreau is. There's a ton of parallels there with real life and how Favreau kind of hit the rocks with some critics, both personally and in this film, and you know, decided to just like take his show and go out on the road. And instead, what he does here is he turns it into a food truck with John Leguizamo, and they tour the country while they bring the food truck back from Florida back to California. And so it's a really, really enjoyable road trip film. But more than anything, what it does is it sells this food as something that we can all spend time and make ourselves. None of the food really in the film, except for the food that you see when they're originally at the restaurant, is something that's really out of reach. There's one scene in particular where he makes grilled cheese for his son that is just like, oh man, it looks like the best grilled cheese you probably ever had. And it's like, but grilled cheese, we've probably all made grilled cheese, but we've all pretty much made it in a toaster. And like, this is definitely one of those things where it's like, oh, we were doing that way wrong. We should have been doing that on a skillet. What were we thinking? You know, this is definitely a film that like showcases food. And what I love about it that it does as well is it brings you to each different region. It shows him changing up the menu a little bit to suit each region, the food that he has available to him and things like that. So it's an exploration of accessible food that's also delicious. And it's also an exploration of just kind of our country as a whole and what it means to just kind of get back to roots and get back to doing something that you love. So, yeah, that's my food movie pick.
Isn't that one actually available somewhere too, Bill?
It might be on Netflix.
It might have been on Netflix.
Now.
I really wish we had ads for Netflix now, because this would be great.
Oh God! If y'all don't realize what's going on right now, we also have a chat going on side by side to the Skype conversation, and they finally posted a picture from the ratatouille, and oh my God, my mind hurts.
So my food movie pick. I put a lot of thought into this. I was gonna say Ratatouille because, I guess tying in with what we're gonna talk about next, that's a movie that made me cry. But I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to choose a movie that is wholly about food and food's place in our life and the sort of mystical connection that we have with food and the oddity of food, which if you think about it is you consuming something to gain power from it. And so I'm going to fade this music in so people can get the reveal. I have chosen to talk about Yes. Yes, indeed. It's the terrifying, unknowable wonder that is Ravenous. Ravenous is a film that, I mean, I say, because we've recorded this before, again, I'll say, I know that it's a cult film. I just feel like it deserves a bigger cult. Because this is just one of the most batshit crazy movies that I've ever seen. It's directed by Antonia Bird, who passed away, I think, not too long ago. And it involves one of my favorite actors, Guy Pearce, and another one of my favorite actors, Robert Carlyle, who you may know as Begbie from Trainspotting. Shout out to the T2 trailer that came out. So, what is Ravenous about? It's a cannibal story with, like, little bits of a vampire myth in there. It pulls from Native American stories about something called a Wendigo, which is someone that eats a person and gains their strength, but then becomes addicted to eating human flesh. It's all they can think about. It's all they want. So it follows a captain in the Mexican-American War who pretends to be dead, is placed under a pile of bodies, and then gets some of the blood from the bodies in his mouth, and then takes over this Mexican outpost. But everyone knows he's a coward, so even though they give him a medal, they ship him off to a remote outpost in the Sierra Nevadas. And while he's there with a kooky cast of characters, which involves David Arquette as a pothead private in the army, and Jeremy Davies as a religious sort, what happens to poor Guy Pearce is that Robert Carlyle appears. And for a while, it was my understanding that anytime Robert Carlyle appeared in a movie, no good could come of him. And I think, the full Monty aside, not many movies have really tried to disprove my theory. He tells a story about being lost in the mountains with a wagon train and how they turned to cannibalism and how he ran away when there were only three people left. And so it's this evil Colonel Ives and this poor, poor woman who I think is named Mrs. McCready. And so everyone's like, we gotta go try to save Mrs. McCready. And from that point on, the twists and the turns and the oddity sort of mount. And then it all comes to a head in this absolutely brutal, no-holds-barred brawl that goes on, I would say, 10 minutes. Because when you eat someone in this movie, you sort of become a superhero, just in terms of the amount of punishment you can take. So the movie really grapples with consumption of all kinds, both food and land and all other kinds. And it's just fun, and it's awesome, and I don't think enough people have seen it. But whenever I think about food, I have to think of this movie, because there's so many great lines revolving around eating and or eating a person that you just really can't find anywhere else, because where would you? And the last line to this movie almost became an inscription on the inside of my wedding band, but it was too big to fit, which is unfortunate. And yeah, because this movie's just fantastic. And also, I mean, we've talked about kind of food aesthetically. There is a stew in this movie that, even though I know it is filled with the meat of a man, I would still eat, because it looks absolutely delicious. And I'm a fan of stew.
I don't think I've ever looked at stew and been like, man, that looks really good.
Really? Oh, man. You get like the big chunks of like a potato and the carrots and other stuff. And you just got like that succulent, like falls apart, melt in your mouth meat.
Yeah, but like the big chunks of carrots and potatoes, all that says to me is this is going to be a messy food item.
Bill,
because I have.
You're from Texas.
Go ahead. Yeah.
So you've never really known the cold.
Okay.
I'm just saying.
I mean, I've been fucking cold before. I don't know what you're talking about.
I think that for people who live in a climate that gets cold and stays cold for months on end, there's something
innately
wonderful.
I'm in fucking Chicago.
Yeah, Michael, do you like stew?
It's fine. It's okay. I'm not going to be able to muster up like massive enthusiasm for Stew.
Oh,
exactly.
I'm more excited about honestly the grilled cheese that Bill was talking about than Stew.
Stew is like soup,
but with food in it.
Yeah, but like I'm not saying that stew is bad. Or I'm not saying that stew isn't delicious, but there's nothing about the look of it that makes me just be like, oh, yeah, I got to get some stew in my life.
Oh,
no,
man.
I'm just like, I just look at it. And I'm like, yeah, like I could go for some of that.
You get a big ladle of stew when you got like the chunks of food sticking out of it and you got thick broth.
I don't want the chunks. I want small little pieces, but I don't want the big chunks that I have to like, because I'm eating it with a spoon most of the time, and I'm not going to like eat like half a potato off of the spoon and then like drip all my soup all over the place. And then like, no, that just seems like a very messy mess.
All right. Well, we can give this to Twitter.
I reiterate that this conversation was cannibalism.
Yeah. I
quickly moved on as soon as I could. So
the man who brought up Hannibal, which yes, is a great show, and does have a lot to do with food, but is not a movie. So I couldn't revel in that as much as I wanted to. But our Twitter followers found themselves hemmed in by no such standards. So how about we get into the responses that we got on Twitter to this question? Again, if you would like to answer questions like this to hear me butcher your name while we read them out on the air, follow us at Film Stage Show, and let's kick the Rockin' Robin into gear. Okay, tweets. We have Anna Swanson, who said Ratatouille. Nacho Rodriguez, who said Ratatouille. Tyler said Ratatouille by far. John McGuire: watched Pixar's Ratatouille with my kids the other night. We loved it. I like Winterbottom's The Trip, too. Danny Pacheco said Julia and Julia, Ratatouille, Jiro Dreams of Sushi. Trevor Burns said Ratatouille-ing, which, again, please Google, everyone. Pitt said Super Size Me. Tony Hines said The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. Jim Hutchinson said Big Night. Jordan Raup said Babette's Feast, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. Ashley Hahn says, does The Help count? Yeah, I would say so. There's fried chicken and a terrifying pie in that. And Ann Lee's Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. Kenneth Crahelli, who gave us this, actually benefits from us fucking up the first recording, because his tweet came in, I think, yesterday. Jiro Dreams of Sushi, food as life. Tampopo, food as love and as life. And No Reservations, food as job, as love, as life. Harry, does eating Raoul count? Rob Bickmore said that'll be Tampopo. Only seen it once decades ago, but it makes me hungry for noodles the second I think of it. Nick Newman, the level bastard he is, said Solo. Rodolfo Ciaros, or Claros, I can't tell if that's an L or an I, said El Bulli was alright, but the first season of PBS's Mind of a Chef is so damn good. TheMovieWaffler.com said Cannibal Holocaust. G. Hassani Gooding said Soul Food. Vanessa said Silence of the Lambs. LWB, I always like Who's Killing the Great Chefs of Europe. Mune said The Scent of Green Papaya. Aziz said Jiro Dreams of Sushi is very good, and The Neon Demon. Queen of the Slipstream said Babette's Gastbud. I don't know how to say that. Thomas Keller said Fast Food Nation is pretty great. Hard to go wrong with Linklater. Jim Hutchinson said Big Night. Amendables said Ain't Nobody Said Big Night. Nathan Hill said Chef and Big Night. Casey said the scene in Chef when he makes grilled cheese for his son. Good Lord. And yes, that was spelled L-A-W-D. That wasn't me being cute. We also have B33, who said Chef. Johnny said Chef. Kunst said Chef. Also Ratatouille and Ratatouille. Mitchell McDonald said Chef and Ratatouille come to mind, but really the Hannibal TV show is the best cooking I've seen on TV. We also have Tyler, who said Hannibal the series cooking scenes are fucking amazing. And then we have three more, so we gotta start that song over again. Let's go. Whew. Coming off of Facebook, we got Nicole Sykes, who said Like Water for Chocolate. Juliet Azarani said Fried Green Tomatoes. And we have Akito Sakata, who said, this is something that I'd actually thought of, Hook when the Lost Boys dreamed that they had food.
Yeah.
Is, I you know, it feels weird saying this again, but it's true. A scene that thrilled me as a child and absolutely disgusts me as a grown man.
I still love it. Still love it. And I did want to mention one other film or film scene, and that's definitely The Sandlot when he's teaching Smalls how to make a s'more.
That's a good one. Mm-hmm. I feel like there are a lot of movies with good food scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe it's that'll tough. Be something we can talk
yeah,
about.
Yeah, like what one of my favorite sequences is actually The Matrix, when he's in The Matrix and I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but it's the traitor and he's eating the steak.
Oh, the steak. Oh.
Yeah.
And, and he's just like, I know this is nothing but synapses and like yeah. shit like that. And I know sure, this is completely unreal, but he's just like, but it's so fucking good.
I was and you're just like, yes! For that steak. That steak is like perfect.
Yeah.
Wait, I can't be trusted either.
He cuts into it with like a butter knife too. He's just like, and you're just like, oh, give me that.
All right. Man, okay. Now is the perfect time to say that my food didn't arrive before we started podcasting. So I am super hungry right now.
Same.
yeah, we're all suffering from that. So
no, no, not all of us.
Not Bill, because Bill ate as we were beginning.
are you ready for human flesh yet, Brian?
I'm always down to eat some human flesh because either I'm going to become a continental European psychiatrist, or I'm going to become as strong as 10 men.
I am very gristly. I'm gonna let y'all know. I am very
Bill,
gristly.
I got some bad news for you. If you're gristly, that means you're going in a stew.
Ah, damn it!
You slow cook. You slow cook some gristly meat on a low heat. Man, that stuff breaks down. Anyway, now that I'm considering eating Bill, let's move on to our next topic. Which is Tears for Films. And before people get their hopes up, no, I did not decide to do a Tears for Fears song.
Damn it.
All right. That is Leslie Gore singing It's My Party, and I'll cry if I want to. So it can't be denied that I cried during Arrival. Michael Snydell, on the other hand, his robot heart, cold and lifeless, twitched not at all. He felt nothing. Now, Mike and I were discussing another podcast on the group Slack, and let me remind you again, this episode is not brought to you by Slack. we were discussing
surprisingly
on another podcast that I listened to. One of the hosts was attempting to talk about Arrival and broke down into tears and could not continue and had to be rescued by his co-host. So what happened is this inspired Mike to ask the question, when did like crying become a marker of a good movie? And so Bill Graham took this conversation that we had and suggested that we talk about crying in movies. Is it a mark of a good movie? Does a movie have to make you cry in order to reach like an ascendant level of goodness? And is it okay? This is something we talked about last time that I just want to get on the table right now. Because Mike, you said, have you ever been like frustrated when a movie made you cry? So is it the type of thing where you can cry during a movie and actually like be angry at the movie for making you cry? So it's all about tears. It's all about films that make us cry or try to make us cry. So let's get into it. Michael Snydell, you're the heartless bastard here. What's your fucking problem, man?
Brian, you probably did better than my first take where I rambled on for a bit about crying. So, audience, you're being saved right now. But anyways. Another reason why I brought this up, besides for the fact that Brian and I talk about apparently all the other podcasts behind their back, is that this year there's been a group of films that have been discussed in relation to how vigorously they can work tear ducts. And so, you know, those films, or I suppose I should say that these were all festival films. So at Sundance and TIFF, Manchester by the Sea, A Monster Calls, Lion, and Arrival have all been films that I've seen many critics from outlets ranging from all over discuss in terms of how they made them emotional. And in some cases, people talked about that as a positive, as talking about the merits of the film. And in some cases, people talked about being manipulated. So again, as Brian said, I just kind of wanted to have this larger conversation on the podcast and be able to talk about our personal experiences with crying and whether
you also wanted to shame the people on the other podcast who cried. So we're going to talk about it. We're going to play a clip. We're going to name names.
And then maybe we'll all have a good cry.
Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah. No, so, we're not going to do any of that horrible stuff I just said.
Yeah. What I just want to do is, you know, get a sense of all your guys about your experiences with crying, whether you enjoy it, whether you think, again, it's a mark of a good film. And again, there are many exceptions in this case. Like, as we can get into, you know, there's some movies that are structured as things that are trying to get you to cry, you know, things that are presented from the outset as tearjerkers, and those are exceptions. But there's also things like, well, guys, let's just get into it. I'm going on
yeah,
for
two. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
so
God's
so
sakes,
I'll take first crack at it. So right. I really, really don't mind crying at a film. I think when a good film makes you cry, and Brian mentioned this last time, but when a good film makes you cry, it just makes it just a little bit sweeter. It just makes it like the emotional punch is just a little bit more when it's already a good film, and it can boost it, you know, just a little bit. You know, whether that's in like some kind of stupid scoring system or whatever it is, like there's always a moment where you're like, oh yeah, I cried at that movie. Yeah, that was a really good movie. And you're like, yeah, okay, now let's stop talking about it, right? You know, but it's one of those things where I think it definitely matters, like where you are kind of in your kind of present moment. But more than anything, I think for me, what is frustrating now more than ever is I guess I get salty tears now, and they now are kind of like when you start to cry and all of a sudden your eyes start to hurt because you've been crying and you're like, oh, now my eye itches and now like my eyes hurt. Now like I am completely taken out of the movie. Right. So there's like now like yeah, there are moments where like even like especially like if you're watching like a 3D film and heaven forbid you're like me where you already wear glasses, so you have to wear glasses on top of your glasses.
Oh
and
my then, God, Bill. Yes.
And then if you have to cry in the middle of the film, you have to take not only the 3D glasses, but then you have to take your own glasses off. Oh. You have to rub your eyes, and then you have to carefully put each layer back on and look at this like dingy, like, you know, picture on the screen.
So logistically, like, when you cry at a movie, it literally like takes you out of the movie.
Yeah. Like there are certain moments where I'm just like, oh no, not right now. Like, oh man. But like, okay. So like logistics put aside, like there is something just really gratifying about a film that's really, really good, that has gotten you so wrapped up into the story and the characters that a emotional gut punch moment kind of will make you cry. There's kind of an idea of like diminishing returns as well, unless of course we are, and we all have to address the elephant in the room, and that is Up. And that movie is just a goddamn disaster as far as like, if you're a stone cold bastard, like, you are gonna cry at that movie. It doesn't matter.
Like me, apparently.
And not only that, it is gonna start with the tears. Like, yeah, within the first 5 minutes, it's like, yeah, I already got you.
It's like a boxing match that begins with a sucker punch. It's like
it does. It's just like, oh,
you're sort of prepared because it's a Pixar film, and then you like, you walk up, you touch gloves, and then it just hits you immediately. It's like, ha ha.
Yeah.
And you
like that movie is one of the rare exceptions where like, and what it makes me realize is like so many other films that try and get to that moment and just don't quite get there. But I'll hand it off to Brian at this point.
Yeah. So I have 2015 vision, so I don't have the glasses problem.
You bastard.
I know. I'll say this. So it is possible for me to be moved by a movie and recognize its craft without having to cry. I was, after the first time we recorded this failed, I realized that I never really came up with an example of that. But Revolutionary Road is a very heartrending film. It's very sad, but it didn't make me cry because I think while it perfectly portrayed all of this stuff, I never felt any real closeness with the characters. Mendez is one of these people who I think he's a great stylist, but sometimes that keeps me on the outside. So I never cried during Revolutionary Road, despite the fact that that movie gets super sad. And
especially at the end.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
Meanwhile, something like Arrival, because I felt like I was inside that movie and I felt like I had really connected with the characters, I wasn't just empathizing, but I was fully feeling that. And I was responding to them as people, not just as like a piece of art. So that's where most of my crying comes from. Now, at the same time, there have been times when I've cried and it was a strong emotional reaction. But it wasn't in a movie that could be qualified as, like, good or great. I'm going to start off with the less embarrassing of my two stories. The less embarrassing one is We Bought a Zoo.
Oh, okay.
Which is a movie that has all the emotional subtlety of, I don't know, someone, like, grabbing you by the shoulders and
spraying. A cattle prod?
Yeah, the emotional subtlety of a cattle prod. Yeah, I'd say that works. I wrote one of the reviews back when I had, well, I still have my own site. I wrote a review to We Bought a Zoo, and I had been like wrestling with the fact that it made me cry and like that it was effective, but it was like too baldly effective. And like, I have two friends who came over to my house to drink one night, and they were like, put a movie on. And I put on We Bought a Zoo because I was like, I didn't remember how devastating it could be. So I was like, that's a fun movie, we can get into that. You know, who doesn't like Matt Damon? And these two friends have since said that I'm never allowed to pick a movie again because they were just bawling. And like, it wasn't...
That's all right. You at least you didn't pick Bridge to Terabithia.
Oh, God.
Or a dog movie.
So, yeah, no dog movies.
So, like, movie.
So he would start crying and then she would start crying, or sometimes they'd cry together. And then one time one of them left to make a drink. The woman, Jen, left to make a drink. And then she comes back and she sees Arthur crying. She's like, oh my God, what did I miss? And he explains the scene to her and then she starts crying. And so in my review, I wrote, whereas other films work with meticulous focus and surgical precision to hit just the right notes and affect just the right kind of tonal pitch, you employ something akin to a blunt force trauma or a bombing run. In the name of destroying our defenses and impacting us in a positive and uplifting way, you employ a scorched earth style blitz of music, cinematography, Jesus, and story to reach our heartstrings and play them like a fucking slap bass. And it works. My God, how it works.
Are you playing the bass?
Slapping the bass. So what, like, that's like a problem for me, but I guess it's so obvious and it worked. And I think that's what really matters. Like, I still felt for those characters, even though everything was so bold. Now, on the other hand, when I see something like Collateral Beauty, like, I didn't feel like We Bought a Zoo cared if I cried or not. I definitely felt like it wanted me to care about the characters and invest. So that's like just a little icing on that We Bought a Zoo zebra-shaped cake. Something like, and I haven't watched it, but just from the trailers and the story, something like Collateral Beauty, if I see it and if it makes me cry, I'm almost 100% certain that I will feel nothing but anger.
Yep. Same here.
No, but you... okay, but that's what I was trying to get into, is that, like, you know going into that, that that's trying to go for your heartstrings.
But I don't feel like it's playing fair. Like, I feel like...
How is it not playing fair if it's like, hey, and what do you want, like, a giant disclaimer that just says, hey, we're trying to make you cry?
But I feel like it's not trying to, I feel like, I'm trying to think of the best way to put this. If, as I said about Bill, it's a boxing match, I feel like We Bought a Zoo maybe was like a guy who was 100 pounds of muscle more than me and, like, didn't keep his punches above the belt and... like, that's fine because it's still a boxing match, but I feel like Collateral Beauty, like, as soon as the bell rings, pulls a fucking gun on me, you know? Like, I feel like there's just a lack of, like, good faith effort to do it in a way that's not just, like, offensive. And I feel like the trailer, again, I haven't seen these, but, like, the trailer for sure. A Monster Calls, it comes very close to that line. And I haven't seen the movie, and I'm sure that, again, I'll probably cry, but I think that that's going to be one of those movies where when we see it and when we talk about it, there may be some words exchanged, depending on where we all fall.
There might be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, the other story.
Well, I guess, like, okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Wait, no, Brian, I mean, I just wanted to ask, so, like, are you susceptible to things that are identified as tearjerkers, you know, recent things like Pursuit of Happiness or, you know, Terms of Endearment or Sophie's Choice or, any number of these things? Or are you automatically have a wall up for those things?
I think I automatically have a wall. Like, because if you look at We Bought a Zoo, like, there are moments that I think are supposed to make you cry because they're sad. For anyone who doesn't know, that movie is about a family who the mother has died of cancer, probably. And... and they buy a zoo. But the parts that I cried at were, like, the parts when they come together as a family and, like, work through things. It was like catharsis. It's not like fucking Rent when someone dies of AIDS and it's like you're supposed to cry because, oh, look at this poor angel dying in front of you. Like, I don't often like those, but I think... like, Arrival gets away with a sad moment making me cry, but also, again, I think it's because there's a catharsis to it. Like, I don't find sadness to be that compelling. I find the ways in which we deal with sadness to be compelling. And this is, like, The Leftovers. The Leftovers is a huge thing about this, because, like, everyone in Leftovers is sad to the point of madness. But it's the moments of, like, real catalytic change or understanding in that show that get me. And they get me hard. Like, well, bro, let's not. They get me very effectively. Jesus Christ. It's first day and I'm tired. So The Leftovers is a perfect prize fighter. Like, it feints and it jabs and it gets you to let your guard down because you think you know where it's going. And then it haymakers you to the fucking face and you're down flat. Like, that's what I'm looking for. I don't want to lose the fight to keep my composure because I'm an Irishman, so my emotions are a fucking battlefield. I don't want to lose the fight because someone has overcome me with brutal force that wasn't agreed to beforehand, I guess.
I don't know. I don't know if I'm susceptible to them, but I just generally avoid them, just kind of as a rule. Like, I still haven't seen The Notebook. I still haven't seen a lot of these films that people are like, oh, but it's so good. And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure. But I don't need that in my life. Not really.
Yeah.
Wait, what know, do you like, mean you don't? No, I'm kind of curious about that. But what do you mean you don't need that in your life? Because that is interesting. Because I do know people. I mean, generally they're not writers, but I do know a lot of people. You know, if I'll recommend something and I say it's sad or somber, or you know, it's going to be emotionally, if it's going to wring you out, they will absolutely say, you know what, I don't know if.
But see,
that's for me, so, and I find that interesting.
I'd like to I'd like to say to that very quickly. I don't want a movie that's going for it. Like, I don't want a movie that's asking for it, or that's like that's its set out goal. Because I feel like, again, it's not going to play fair. It's not going to try to get me to there naturally through empathy. It's going to try to do it through circumstance, like a BuzzFeed post. You know, that's not a narrative. That's just like, and I hate this word, that's just triggers.
Mm-hmm.
Bill, what about yourself?
So for me, The Notebook and similar films are like just walking, talking tragedies. And like, I get that. Mm. And like, I mean, we've both already talked a little bit about like Jackie, like in kind of behind the scenes talk.
Sure.
And like, I adore that film. I really, really enjoy it. And I don't think there's a better definition of a somber, sad film than that. And yet, sure. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Now, did I know that going in that it was going to be as dour and kind of sad as it is? No, but I didn't like understand
context.
I mean, yeah, like you know, but I didn't know how kind of upbeat or how much it was going to be looking forward versus looking backwards. And that film is all about looking backwards. It rarely looks forward, and so. That film is just an emotional gut punch the entire time. It doesn't and it plays fair with that, but it doesn't make any bones about it being anything but what it is. But like films like I don't know, like I said, The Notebook, and The Notebook is sure. kind of a film that. Has been well regarded as just a film in general, but also a tearjerker. Right. So. Like, I've been avoiding it simply because of the tearjerker aspect, not necessarily because it's a good film or things like that. What I mean by I don't need that in my life it is like a film like 43 Dresses or 29 Dresses or 23, whatever
it's
the fuck.
29.
That
means. I don't know why.
29 know, Dresses.
It no, it's 20. I just watched this. What is
Wait,
it? 28
27?
Dresses? 27 Dresses. There we go.
27. I think it's 27 Dresses. Yeah, it is. I just looked it up.
I guess eventually she's going to have like one or two more anyways, but whatever.
Her marriage at the end of that movie doesn't work out?
No, I'm thinking that maybe she goes to another wedding.
You can't be a bridesmaid if you're married.
James deserves better. Let's be honest. Come on.
You don't have to be the bridesmaid to wear a dress, though.
Yeah, but those are bridesmaid dresses. That's specifically what it's referencing.
I understand that. I understand.
Okay, what are we talking about?
I don't even know anymore.
But like, so my point is like films like that. I don't really need that in my life because there's the point of that film is to be sappy and it's to be kind of pull at your heartstrings. And like, there's enough of that in like daily, like listening to the news and shit like that, that like I don't really need a film to like, sit me down and just like make me cry, and that's the whole point of it.
Films. I'm sorry, go ahead. Well, to that level, I was gonna say, like, I think one of the reasons that I like shy away from these films that I was talking about with the trailers is for the same reason that I usually shy away from something like Ouija the movie or like those horror movies where like the trailer is nothing but creepy children bending their necks back and like things popping up and screaming.
That's my shit.
Whereas, like, The Witch or The Descent or It Follows, like, I want a movie that's going to lead me there. I don't want a movie that's going to, like, demand it from me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. I think fear and sadness are, like, two very elemental feelings. And I think that, like, sure. It just strikes me as a little lazy when movies do this. And I hope that maybe that juxtaposition helps to clarify my points a little bit.
Sure. One thing I did, interesting. One thing I did want to bring up that I brought up last time, and look, I'm just going to go ahead and say that, like, yeah, I'm gonna keep referring back to the last time we did this podcast because we did this 2 days ago, and I feel like I brought up some good points. So, you know, sue me, whatever.
Go for it.
Yeah, I'm plagiarizing myself. But one of the things that I really thought, and, you know, haven't had enough time to do some research on last time, but one of the things I brought up was I really, really want to hear about filmmakers and hear their side of it and kind of understand and get to know whether they understand when they're making a movie that's a tearjerker, and like when they think certain moments are going to cause tears from the audience and things like that, you know, whether they're going to like really kind of like punch up the music just a little bit, and, you know, just really kind of hammer it home that this is the moment when you're supposed to cry. I wonder if there's like, you know, some screenplays that are really sad films where like, and the audience cries, and, you know, like I'm really curious about that, because I've yet to hear any filmmaker actually talk about, you know, the emotional beats of a film, specifically when it comes to crying. I've heard them talk about a lot of things. There's a famous instance of Steven Spielberg talking about Jaws when, Brody is feeding the fish or chumming the water, and the Jaws, heretofore known as Bruce, comes out of the water and scares the shit out of every audience member back in like 1976. But he watched test audiences and he realized he got addicted to their screams, and he loved it so much that he added more production, and he took money out of his own pockets to make another sequence when Hooper is down in the bay, and he's like looking around in this boat, and he looks through this boat, and it has like a hole in it, and all of a sudden this other diver's like face like falls right into the screen, and it scares the shit out of the people again. Well, what he didn't realize was that when he added the second scream, he had lost the trust of the audience, and the audience's reaction to the second scream when, again, Brody is chumming the water, it wasn't as big. And so what he had done was he had kind of betrayed himself and realized, oh shit, like, you know, I got addicted to the screams, and I didn't realize like I'm making the first real big, real gut-wrenching scream, I'm lessening it. So like, I really want to hear a filmmaker, I don't know, like James Cameron or, I mean, I'm not even sure like who would be kind of the person to talk to, because you don't want the sappy person, but you want maybe you want the person that has like three or four moments in the film where like people are going to cry. And
any Pixar film, I feel like we could get their director.
Yeah. If you get them, I mentioned last time, WALL-E, I think I cried like three or four times when I saw that film. Jesus, that movie just wrecked me. I think it was like 19. Yeah.
Okay.
I was, and I saw it opening day, and I was excited like a small little child. Yeah, I got a bunch of my friends together, and they were like, "Bill, you wanna see WALL-E? This is what you wanted to pick this weekend?" I'm like, "Yeah, this is my shit."
Yeah. So, in that vein, and I guess, you know, Mike, you asked us about times that we cried at movies, and this makes a point that I think hasn't been made yet. It is possible for a movie to affect me and make me cry, but just because of that, it doesn't mean it's a great movie. And the movie that I bring up to prove this point, which is sort of the inverse of my Revolutionary Road is a great movie but didn't make me cry. This movie is not a great movie, but it did make me cry.
Good book,
movie,
too.
What was that?
Good book as well.
Oh, yeah. It's a very good book, actually. Better than the movie. But the movie that made me cry the most, that I pretty sure is not a great movie, is The Land Before Time 2, The Great Valley Adventure. I loved Land Before Time as a child, and in 1994, when this movie came out, I was about 7 years old, and went to Blockbuster, got it, went home, watched it, destroyed me to the point that my mom had to put me in the car, and we had to return the movie, because, like a cursed doll in a horror movie, she could not have that thing around me.
So hold on. I've heard this story the second time now, yeah. And I'm curious. You were 7 years old.
7 years old.
She couldn't leave you at the home alone.
I was inconsolable, Bill.
Oh, okay. So I don't know. Like I would just be like, okay, here's some ice cream. I will be right back, and make that thing disappear.
For my mother, following this movie, because
everyone
doesn't remember the end of the first Land Before Time. The herbaceous dinosaurs, they get to the Great
What?
Herbaceous.
Call them herbivores.
No, but like, what's the adjective form of herbivore? Like,
I thought herbivore is an adjective.
But like, you can be a carnivore.
I don't know if herbaceous
is carnivorous.
I don't know if herbaceous is a word, but it sounds like something else.
Herbivorous? That doesn't sound right. Anyway, the leaf eaters have found the Great Valley, and they go there, and that's great. And then one day they find an egg, and that egg hatches, and it's a baby sharp tooth that they name Chomper. Gentlemen, I don't know if you've noticed, but in your Skype chat, I have put a picture of Chomper. He is adorable. He is the cutest motherfucker on earth. And they're having fun. Everything's great. And then he eats a dragonfly. Everyone realizes that he's going to grow up to be a sharp tooth. He's going to be a meat eater. So they cast him out of the Great Valley. This child who, even amongst dinosaur children, is like an infant. They cast him out. And I was like just devastated as a child. And even thinking of it now, it's still like a really fucked up thing to do in a movie for kids. Because what it basically says is, yes, children, some people are too dangerous to be friends with and should be removed from society. No movie has scarred me as deeply on an emotional level as The Land Before Time 2, The Great Valley Adventure. But, like, I'm not going to say that's Pantheon all-time great movie. It's just not going to happen, because it's not. But at the same time, it moved me to a horrible place that took me many, many days to recover from. In fact, I had to fight, after we talked about this the last time, I had to fight every impulse in my body to go to, like, the Land Before Time Wikia and see, like, if he showed up again.
Chomper? Of course.
Because there's
a
part of me that's still really worried about Chomper.
Just in the
name.
No, believe
me. Chomper's in the rest of it. I've seen a lot of them.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
Just in the name of like, consistency, it is herbivorous, I will say.
Okay, so it is herbivorous.
Yeah.
All right. Not herbaceous.
No, not herbaceous.
Yeah. And I was a child, obviously, but I don't think that matters, because I mean, as a child, I probably cried at Bambi, but I would probably still cry at Bambi now, because there's something there. Like, that's a beautiful, well-made movie that reaches across the aeons. I really don't think I could get through The Land Before Time 2, The Great Valley Adventure. So, yeah.
Do I need to talk about Marley and Me, guys, or do you think we've We've covered it sufficiently.
I think we've talked a lot. So if you want to wrap us up with Marley and me, we can skip the other two things that we talked about the last time and save those.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You don't...
We're over an hour.
I have to wrap it up? I don't want to wrap it up. That is absolutely a Brian J. Rowan job.
Fine. I'll wrap it up after you're done talking about Marley and me.
Bill, the last time you were talking about, you know, some things that don't quite follow our discussion, you know, things like Click. Brian, obviously you just brought up Land Before Time 2, and the example I wanted to talk about is Marley and Me, which is not a good movie. I think we went on a pretty decent rant last time about what a shitty dog Marley is.
Yeah,
but
talked about how much we hated that dog. And then we badmouthed Mother Teresa for a sec, too.
Right. God, I wish this still existed. Damn it. And maybe misremembering it just because it was so traumatic when I was growing up. I'm not even sure when Marley and Me came out. But anyway, there is, from what I remember, nearly the third act, or maybe it's just the last 20 minutes. But
came
anyways,
2008.
The last 20 minutes. All right, 2008. That's still a while ago. Takes place on a veterinarian's table. And it goes through a long montage of the entire dog's life and many, many times when he was a piece of shit. But I guess what this brings me to is that, you know, as much as we can talk about – we talked about how we generally react towards films that are trying to get that emotion out of us, or, you know, things that – But I guess one thing we haven't talked about is that there are a number of things where it seems like one scene manipulates us into this feeling, and then we retroactively feel like something is more profound than it is. I guess that it specifically goes along with Click, Bill. Is that fair to say?
Makes it more profound? I don't think it necessarily makes it more profound. It makes me more angry.
Sure. No, what I'm saying is it gives the film unearned weight. Those individual
it makes
scenes.
It gives it the appearance.
So my example was Pride Hello? And Prejudice and Zombies. And there's a sequence in the middle of that film where there is a brilliant fight between the two main characters, and it's kind of sexy, it's kind of erotic, it's kind of dirty, it's a lot of fun, and you're just like, and the movie to that point is just kind of like riding like a decent wave, like it's not like a woo wave, but it's like a wave that you can kind of ride and be like, yeah, this is okay, like. Yeah, this could go on for a little bit. And then it hits that moment and you're just like, holy shit, why is the rest of all of this film? It's like a mountain in the middle of just like a valley. And it's just like, yep, here's a shining moment. And you're like, wait, that one moment makes everything else in this film feel worthless. Like it makes it feel like I spent, you know, 2 hours to get 5 minutes of like really good high quality cinema.
Right. And then like if you're capable of that, why is everything else so bad?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So retroactively, it makes you angry at the entire film because you're like, okay, like you weren't even close to making me cry. And then like the last like 5 or 10 minutes, you made me cry. And it's like, what have you been doing for the rest of this movie? Like, you know, again, from now on, forever and ever, I will be like, up, maybe cry in the first 5 minutes. What have you been doing for the last hour? Like, what is your goal been? Has it not been to make me cry? And now you're making me cry? Like, fuck you, movie. You're going to make me cry at the end.
So, Mike, you were saying about Marley and Me?
I just like how legitimately angry Bill got at the end there. Like, you're just kind of like talking and saying, and then you just realized how angry you got.
And you know what? You know what? It's not okay. It's not okay, movie. It's fucking not okay.
You could have been good. You could have been a contender.
So the last part of Marley and Me for you functioned in that way, I assume, is what you were going to say.
Yes, it does.
The appearance of having any kind of emotional weight, but it was like an unearned sentimentality.
Sure.
Just because you don't want to speak ill of the dead. Even though, sure, I will say again, holy shit, what a terrible dog. As a man who owns a terrible dog, that dog still is uber terrible.
You know, PSA to people putting dogs in your movie, just for once, let him fucking live. Just once.
Well, I got happy news for you. You should watch this movie called The Secret Life of Pets.
I mean, no one dies.
That'd be so dark if at the end of that movie all of them died.
Oh, Jesus. No. They all got taken to the pound, but it was too crowded.
Jesus Christ.
No.
Yeah, so
no, that movie does not end like Toy Story was threatening to end. No, that's not how that movie ends.
No, that'll be The Secret Life of Pets 3. So yeah, I'll wrap up by saying, you know, people, a lot of times people expect something to happen to a person who's just had a child. And I know it's a meme in our culture that, like, I've had a baby, so now I should be like super attuned to things and like cry during Charmin commercials or some nonsense like that. But like, Pete's Dragon came out, and that's a movie that's all about like finding family and losing family and creating family. And like, if anything was going to affect me purely out of a sense of like fatherhood, that probably would have been it, but it didn't. And I think when we spoke about this last, I said that I'm not one of those people who, you know, fatherhood is affected in that way. Instead, I've actually just gotten like protective in a very sort of alphaistic way. In fact, I think it was during Pete's Dragon that a guy came up to me in the theater while I was sitting there with my wife and child and was like, that baby shouldn't be in here. This is too scary for that baby. And while I was sitting there like placid and reserved and just waiting for this guy to move on, in the back of my head, my thought was, I will murder this man if he gets near my child. At the same time, though, still cried during Pete's Dragon, not because of any of the fatherhood, child growing up, letting go thing, but because I was just like so proud of that movie. Like, I was so happy with that movie and how pure and good it was that like I cried out of pride. Like, I had just watched my daughter do a piano recital or something. Like, that's just where I was.
Because it's a really good fucking movie.
Yeah, and I was just so thrilled.
And to me,
with that.
Like it was so unexpectedly good. Like, I'm a big fan of David Lowry as a director.
Right,
but
you saw him do something there that was like,
yeah,
even more than you thought.
Yeah, no, I mean, it like so many of the, like, look, I didn't like Jungle Book that much. And that was another one of these kind of goofy remake movies where he's just like, ah, Jesus, you're going to take like an animated film and make it into live action? How is this going to go? And I watched it and I was like, holy shit, this went really fucking well.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
Don't ever expect me on the podcast. Don't lay any bets on me on the podcast breaking down and being like, as a father, this movie, like, if I didn't do that during Arrival, it's never going to fucking happen. Like, it's just not. Maybe during a Monster Calls, but probably not again, because I've always empathized in that way. And having a baby didn't unlock some secret level to my emotional resonance with things. But yeah, Pete's Dragon, man. Like, that's one.
Okay, maybe not emotional.
Go ahead.
Maybe not emotional resonance, but I am kind of curious to just like quickly go down this road. Are there things that you are gravitating to more in film? Not necessarily in an emotion, but are there noticing more since being a father?
I've noticed how many damn movies have like a child parent relationship, but I guess like that's about it. I will say no, not really.
Okay.
No, not really. It's like
I was listening to a really interesting podcast with Natalie Portman the other day, and she was talking about how since having a child, she no longer wants to play roles where a child is in danger and the mother or somebody else has to like save them.
So she's not going to be in the Taken reboot.
Yes, not going to be in that. But it was interesting to hear her kind of phrase it like that. And she said, and you would be surprised how many films like are A, floated my way, and I guess B, even made with that specific subject matter. Like, it's like, oh, yeah, that's a very specific thing. Well, and I keep getting handed these scripts. It's like, Jesus, can we not?
It's a very easy path to bathos and empathy is to just like threaten a child and have a parent crying. Like, you know, but it's cheap and it's easy because that is hardwired into us. It's
yeah.
Yeah. And I just, again, like, you know, it's not something that's happened to me. I haven't felt that change in any of my consumption other than the fact that I can't watch Deadwood when I'm carrying my daughter. Like, I've had to avoid things with overt sexuality or violence or profanity only when she's in the room. But like, I don't feel like I've had to shelter myself from anything because my emotional reactions have changed. And I'm calling everyone out. If you do, you're a coward and I don't want to know you.
Jesus.
Ain't
that is him. That is him
parents.
Being, that is him being 50% honest and 50% joking.
Yes.
You sound like somebody on film Twitter right now to pull an obtuse reference.
Yes. Yes, indeed. All right. Well, that's all for today. It's been a wonderful episode. I think we did better this time, guys. I think this time Woo! Was better. Woo! So we've got that going for us. Let me remind everyone at home to check out Mubi. Go to mubi.com/filmstage and you can get a free 30-day trial just in time to see the Jackie Chan double feature featuring Project A and Project A2, as well as
I really LA hope they're 2 hours.
What was that?
I really hope they're 2 hours.
Bill, for your sake, I pray that they're under 2 hours so that you can see them. it's been a true joy. And remember that Mubi is your home for the best of independent, foreign, and all around classic cinema. MUBI.com/filmstage gets you a free 30-day trial. So that is all for today. Let us know what you thought of our crazy thoughts and opinions by finding us on iTunes and giving us a comment and rating, reaching out on Twitter at Filmstage Show, or Facebook by searching The Filmstage Show, and of course going to thefilmstage.com and commenting on the episode page. If you have any ideas for topics that you want to hear about, all you've got to do is bake them into a macaroon, send them to us, and as long as we don't accidentally eat the paper, we will do them. Or, of course, you can use the previously mentioned methods. And speaking of contacting us, let's tell the fine people where you can be found online. Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snydell, where I lament that I have no human emotion and I'm a human or a heartless robot, apparently.
Yep.
And I also write things. I wrote about Atlanta for Pace, top 25 shows of 2016.
Such a good show.
And I also wrote about Siren, which is a full-length version of the VHS segment Amateur Night. Those are both at Pace this week. You can check them out.
All right. Bill Graham.
Okay, you can find me on Twitter at CableBFG, where I will be angrily wiping away tears that make my eyes hurt and make me take off my 3D glasses and then my glasses. It's not fun. Do not be like me. You can also find me writing about movies on The Film Stage and FreshFiction.tv. And that's about it.
All right, and you can find me on Twitter lamenting the exile of Chomper from the Great Valley at Brian J. Rowan. And
I'm going to send you nothing but chomper gifs.
Jeez, thank you. Yeah, I really don't have anything else going on, but of course, filmstage.com and dearfilm.net. Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. And as always, tune in next time.